And it's a lovely Friday here at Carol and Kay. Carol will be joining us again next week, but here co-hosting with me again today, it's Dr. Drew. How you doing,
Yeah,
Dr.
such
Drew?
a privilege. It's Friday. Wow.
What are you doing with your Friday? Do you usually, do you ever take a day off?
Yeah, I do. I mean, when we were in New York, I wasn't doing very much. We were in New York last week where we had the lovely Peter Luger experience. And that week I did not do a lot, and I very quickly started feeling an intense feeling of uselessness. I do not like that feeling at all. I do not dig it. I just don't dig it. And so I came back and just jammed my schedule with all kinds of stuff this week. So you were asking to podcast. Yes, podcast. Let's go. Do how many you want? Let's do them. I do not like feeling useless. It's a really, really unpleasant feeling, which is an interesting point in that these days, I think people, young people like millennials, are obviously striving to for utility and purpose and all this stuff, making a difference, but they're leaving an important step out, and that step is the skill step, the knowledge step. You know what I mean? And Aristotle talked about this many thousands of years ago, and 2,000 years ago, he said, "Look, to lead a good life, yes, service, right? Yes, you should want to do that. That is what good lives are all about. But you must have two things first. You must have," he called, "techne, skill, and phronesis, wisdom." And both those things require training and education. And before you really have something to offer, the other thing that people miss is that the nourishing part of service really happens kind of one-on-one. It doesn't happen on a big scale so much. I mean, it's fun and interesting and good to do large scale stuff. I don't want to discourage people from that, but it's not going to give you what your brain and body really needs, which is more helping a person with a skill set. I mean, that's why, people take on jobs that you go, "Why do you do that?" It's like, because, I have that. It feels good, even though it's tough and you can be traumatizing. People still are willing to do it because it's purposeful.
And I mean, I think that, God, there are so many different ways. There are so many different questions I want to ask. That was so beautifully put. We released an article on the website yesterday on carolnk.com, talking about why it's actually kind of bad to feed the homeless. And I think that plays into like the underlying theory in that article, as
Well,
a,
let's go down that road for a minute,
yeah. It's a
because
short-term solution, right? Like if every, the way I kind of put it was if every person who wanted to really go out and help a homeless person instead of going out and just feeding them, why don't you go and get the requisite training to get that person out of homelessness? Then you create a cycle of support and you can keep perpetuating those cycles as, as they work on that individual level.
Right. It's a
But obviously
great
you're the
point.
expert in this, so
No,
I'll
it's a
shut up.
great point. And but here's been the thought bubble over my head recently, which is of people that, I see all this stuff on social media. Like, look at this lovely person. They're a person too. It's like, yeah. That, of course, those are the people we're worried about. And the thought bubble over my head is, how much training, sir or ma'am, do you have in handling, helping, developing a continuum of care for people with the illnesses that end up on the street? How do you, any training you have to even be able to identify, yes, lovely people get psychiatric illness and addiction. That's why I work with them. I want to restore them back to their full existence. They are lovely, but they're not well. And so if you don't understand or have the training how to identify that in somebody, you will completely miss it. And if you miss it, you certainly aren't going to have the skill set to be able to bring somebody through. Now, going back to feeding people with homeless, it's a challenging ethical question. I get it. I have trouble not feeding and giving things. And but what they need is structure and supervision. And when you treat a psychiatric patient or a drug addict, you create a team that surrounds them. Because you're the you have to have this full, like, sort of wall, and you have to fight against all the symptomatology that is part and parcel of the illness. And as an individual, you almost can't do it. Can't do it as one person. You have to do it as a group of people surrounded. And you have to be a very firm set wall. And it's hard. It's easy to give somebody, I can give somebody heroin. They'll be very happy too. You know what I mean? That's not good for them. And to do the work of getting somebody better is extremely extremely difficult. It is because they will attack you and aggress, and it's the illness that's coming at you, and it comes at you with extreme intensity. Mm-hmm. And one person can't withstand it. One person will sort of cave. But if you have a team there standing firm, eventually the symptoms settle and the person starts to cooperate with the treatment process. And then you keep, and of course there will be, you know, periods of time where stuff pops out, and you just keep it going in the right direction. That is so much harder than going, look how lovely this person is. Let's take a picture. Let's give them a hamburger. See, there's look what they need. Look how happy. Yeah. I mean, of course that's not what they need. And of course, if you've never had any training or never worked in a psychiatric hospital, it's impossible for you to know what you're looking at. You've never seen it. Mm-hmm. You've never been across a continuum of care. You don't even know what I'm talking about. You would actually think I was talking about something called wraparound services, which is a term that means exactly nothing. Yeah. I believe we talked about that last time.
No, wraparound services is nothing. Okay, so question. When you say a team, so a team of stakeholders around one individual, obviously there's going to be certain players who, you know, a relative to the individual. Like if we're dealing with someone who's schizophrenic, who's got a drug problem, they're going to have very different needs to someone who, you know, is just heavily traumatized, and that's where their mental illness stems from.
Yes.
Are there sort of like, and this is so nerdy, I'm sorry, Carol, I know this is supposed to be like our effort Fridays, like, but I love this stuff, man.
She's
like,
got
this
the
is
wrong
all
two
the,
people
this
doing
is all
this
the
thing.
Stuff I care about. Yeah. So are there like key people who, or like key roles that are required for every single individual
who's
suffering from mental
illness?
In
my humble opinion, yes.
Who are those people? Because we need to start creating pathways to create those jobs.
I've been saying that, and you're absolutely correct. And we don't have enough people by any means to meet the needs. In fact, I'm going to give, I told you, I want you to interview my friend Anthony Brown. I'm going to give a talk today at his hospital where he is the head of nursing. And they have, you know, nursing home, they have inpatient psych, they have locked units, they have residential care, they have outpatient treatment. I mean, that's what you need, is this full continuum of care. And for any given individual, now you don't need all of these people all the time. Mm-hmm. Here are the basic constituents of a team. A physician, preferably, in the addiction side, it doesn't have to be a psychiatrist, but in the general psychiatry side, yes. A physician, a doctor, a nurse, a psychologist and or social worker, mm-hmm. and other ancillary trained individuals like psych techs or chemical dependency counselors, those sorts of things can fill out the ranks. And then on top of that, you can bring alumni, people who've graduated and who have made it through this thing. You can train, you know, obviously mutual aid societies like 12-step. They have their own sort of people that will come in and support and are very effective, who've been through it themselves or have done it before. I mean, that's the sort of elements you want to put in place. Now, the doctor may only be there just in the first 5 minutes during an assessment. You don't need me. Go, you know, social worker take over, or social worker and psychologist, or psychologist and chemical dependency counselor. You guys head the team. And any issues, I'll come back. And have you ever heard of splitting behaviors? splitting is what we do when we're children. We go, mommy, I want to have a ice cream. No, I know. Daddy, can I have a pie ice cream? And mommy's mean. She won't talk to me about it. Whatever. They just lie and split. And to get what they want, they pit one person against another. Well, people with mental health issues do that like crazy, especially drug addicts.
Oh, yeah.
And personality disorders and things. Mm-hmm. And so this team, the key sort of structure or sort of dynamic in the team is there must be an absolute unanimity of understanding and philosophy and appreciations of one another's skill set. So when the patient comes to me and goes, Dr. Vinsky, the nurse was so mean to me. I go, nope, she wasn't. I know she wasn't, because I know her. I know she doesn't behave like that ever. Now, if it's somebody that I have a question about, I'm not going to put that person on the team, frankly. But you've got to be able to have absolute, because then when that person comes back and go, yeah, that doesn't sound like her. What's that? What's going on? What is mm-hmm. happening? Let's not get into the split. Let's get into what's happening here.
So, okay. I heard an interview, I think it was with David Letterman, and he was interviewing Kanye West. Mm. And I've actually wanted to ask you about this for ages, and I'm so glad that I've just remembered now. One of the things that Kanye said in his interview that really stuck with me was that when he was, I don't know what the American term for it is, but in the UK we'd call it sectioned. So like when he was like involuntarily held because he was having a psychiatric episode or like a psychotic episode.
Yep.
He said the one thing that he thinks or felt would have made all the difference in that moment was having someone he knew, who he trusted, who was not part of the medical team, who was part of his family, be in the room. Now, you and I know, and like I'm sure a lot of people listening know, that that's not really an option for the demographics that we typically work within the homeless crisis.
Yeah.
You know, they're not the kind of people, like if they had families, they wouldn't be living on the street kind of thing. As I said, that was like sweeping generalization. Yeah. But
most of them have family. They just families can't do anything. They can't get involved because the laws won't let them.
And that is a whole other thing that I'm almost like too scared to get into because we don't want the internet to turn on us on a Friday. We want a nice relaxing weekend.
It's the issue. The issue is the law. Why it's a big problem in California, because the laws in California are the ones that prevent people from being helped. Period.
Yeah.
But anyway, so part of that is the inability, the HIPAA laws as they're interpreted, particularly in this state, where you can't even discuss whether a psychiatric patient is under care.
Like, this is exactly what I wanted to ask. And like, they can't, you can't ask if homeless people have a drug problem, correct, as well?
What you can't go is, Dr. Pinsky, are you treating this patient? Can't tell you. Dr. Pinsky, is this patient, you know, called the hospital? Is my son there? Can't tell you. What's going on with the treatment? My son says he wants me to talk to you. Sorry, I can't talk about it. That's it, period. That's insane. As opposed to if they had a heart attack, I'd be like, God, I'm so glad you're here. Let me tell you about what's happening with him. Mm-hmm. Of course you're going to participate. The family participates.
Yeah.
Of course. Of course they do. If you didn't, it'd be bizarre. He's on a ventilator right now. He can't talk. So let's talk about making some decisions here. And by the way, there's two other things we need in psychiatry. Mm-hmm. We need decision makers for psychiatric care assigned before somebody gets sick, and a directive to the physicians, which is just like when I have a directive, if you end up on a ventilator and in a coma, you have signed a form that says, here's my decision maker. Here's what I want you to do if I come into this state. We need the same thing with psychiatry. When people are stable, you assign directives to the doctor if I get psychotic.
Mm-hmm.
And that's it. It will be able to do some stuff then, but we don't do that.
Why is it that we don't do that? Is that like, what is the kind of underlying reasoning?
I'm not sure they stick, number one, legally, and number two, it doesn't seem like it's a practice yet, and I don't know why. I don't get it. There's no sort of state form for that. The state forms for everything else, but not that.
But one of the things, going back to the kind of Kanye comics, I think that somewhat plays into it, this idea that it's actually better for the person who's having an episode to have someone in the room with them, have someone who's part of their recovery team be that invested kind of source of is that a safe thing though? Create codependencies? Like how would that work?
It can create all kinds of stuff because, you know, family members may not understand what's going on and feed into the patient's stuff and undermine the treating team. So it's a little unrealistic. However, I think what's behind it is something very important. And that is the you know, we use this in recovery all the time, and we use it in treatment of PTSD. I mean, when people don't feel felt or understood, their defensive strategies pop up, right? Mm-hmm. And so think about warriors coming back with PTSD. I'm fine. You can't put them in a regular group and expect them to participate. They have to go into a group with other warriors who've been through similar experiences with similar symptomatologies. And when they say, I understand what you're feeling, that person believes it. Mm-hmm. It cuts through their defenses. Same thing with African-Americans. Same thing with certain cultural groups. Same thing with You could be, you could almost, you know, it's well, about
like
traumatized creating...
women. Yeah. Like,
yeah, women. I mean,
that's
female.
Why
exactly.
The Me Too
Perfect.
Movement worked Perfect. So well, because it was like, well, I still think that we needed to get a lot angrier about it, but, but no, I completely see that. And I think that what's interesting is that kind of plays into this idea that, you know, like the bridge housing, I think, was supposed to be this kind of like, oh, people coming together and like yeah. seeing that they're in crisis and working through right. it together, when all it actually did was just create like one-stop shops. And like, basically, it basically just turned bridge housing into the Hotel Cecil. Did you see that documentary yet on
yeah,
Netflix?
Yeah. With that woman that died in the water tower.
Oh my God. That whole documentary. I was like, I just wanted to say, I think I called Carol and I was like, Carol, we don't need to work anymore. Everyone can just watch this documentary and realize that it can be fully applicable to the entire city of Los Angeles. And that's yeah. where we live now.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But no, I mean, that's what bridge housing has become. So what do you think? Okay, so one of the things that people come to us and ask about all the time, and earlier I wasn't laughing at the Warriors coming back from war. I was laughing because I thought you were bringing up the Warriors again. Because those guys are probably pretty traumatized. But no, I get approached a lot by people who are like, oh, we want to build these like communities out in the desert where like,
yeah, yeah.
I'm sorry, I've seen the camps in Calais. That's not how it really works. Well, and that's not how human behavior works.
It's their fantasy, right? This is a fantasy. Like, we'll give them a place to live. We got all this land. Let's build it out. No. Look up the Trieste plan. That's what they need. If you want to know how you create a continuum of care, Trieste does a pretty good job with that. And mm-hmm. those are generally near urban environments so people can work. I mean, people, you're talking about state hospitals again. Mm-hmm. And yeah, those were kind of in the outskirts back in the day. And people won't go. This is the part that everyone doesn't get. Oh, we'll just, they want housing. We'll give them housing. They won't go. They will not go out to Andrews Air Force Base and to live. I mean, a few will, but mostly no, they won't go. Especially if you require them to stop doing drugs, then forget it.
Yeah, no. That's 90% of the problem out here, really, isn't it? It's the drugs.
Yeah, yeah. And I for people that don't have those problems, let's get them out of this. Let's get all this. We have so many resources and services and opportunities. Let's get them. Let's get it going for people that can work and do work. But this idea that a home and a work will and a job will get so many of these people out of the situation they're in is just so unrealistic. It's upsetting to me. It's so unrealistic because it's such a grave lack of understanding. And in fact, denial that there is such a thing as psychiatric illness. And once you even get through that denial of the process of treatment, which is time consuming and lengthy and requires multiple levels of care.
So what does Caitlyn Jenner need to do after she wins? Like, what do we need to do? We got to like repeal Prop 47, 57, AB 109.
At least modify 47, 57 a little bit. And again, I am not interested in criminalizing homelessness. Stop saying that. That's bullshit.
I am not interested
in criminalizing drug addiction. I'm not interested.
Yeah.
People who are drug addicts and homeless do not belong in the streets, in the prisons, in the nursing homes. They don't belong there. Mm-hmm. But we have to have some way to get them into treatment. We have to have something to motivate people. Maybe stakeholders can come in and we can figure out what that is. There's got to be a way to, because you have a carrot and a stick. That's always how drug addicts come to treatment. That's always how we save their lives. They come in not because things are going great. They come in because their family sends them, the courts send them, somebody sends them into treatment. And they don't come in on their own. They only come in with enough consequences mounted that they come in. So anyway, we got to find some way to create consequences to motivate people in. That's 4757. AB 109 is ridiculous. But I mean, think about the 65,000 criminals that have just been put out on the street. Are there going to be parole officers? Is there going to be halfway houses? Are any monitoring of this? I mean, if you think that that's magically this idea that people are just magically released and they're fine, that is the most bizarre thinking of all time, and it's going to end up in real serious trouble. And I don't know how we come back from it, frankly, because those criminals that a lot of them are going to end up on the street too, because they've not given them the skill set to go back in the world. They just released them.
Yeah.
What do you think? What do you think's going to happen? It reminds me of when they released everyone from the state hospitals. They just pushed everyone out of the state hospitals with zero plan for what those people were going to do. Like, how are they going to get their psychiatric care? How are they going to live? They've been living in an institution. They've been custodial care their whole life. Now magically, because we have some decent medication, magically that's going to be someone who is fully functional. That's how we got homelessness. That's how we got psychiatric patients in the jail system, in the prisons. They don't belong there. But that's mm-hmm. how we did it, by just sending people out into the world without the continuum of care they need. And this recent release of 65,000 criminals in California really reminds me of that.
Well, I mean, it's and since it's a Friday, I'm just going to give a fair warning to the listeners. I am going to swear. I think it's basically Gavin Newsom's way of either saying fuck you to Californians for massively recalling him. I don't know if you saw, I think it was for Gascon, the number of people that came out to recall him. I might be getting this wrong, but I think they needed like 200,000 signatures and they got something like 1.7 million. That is how Californians
are. Newsom or Gascon?
Gascon, and then Newsom is now up to over a million. I think they had to get over a million to recall him in the first place. But and that was a couple of weeks ago that came through, thank God. And I mean, yeah, it does. It just seems like a giant fuck you to Californians. It's just his stupid hair gel brain going, it's so weird, okay, though. He's placating people on his side by being like, oh, look how nice I am at releasing these people from prison. Because no one, like, you're right, no one thinks further ahead than that. No one thinks about the people who will not even bother to show up for their first parole meeting, who aren't going to get rearrested because the cops basically don't have any power because of the law here in California.
Right.
We're going to go out and
Well, I mean, like, I worry about the 65,000 people he's released. Forget the victims of whatever they do.
Oh, yeah.
What are you doing to them? You're setting them up for failure. Yeah.
Yeah. A lot of them won't even have the option. Like, we had, it's one of Carol's friends, I believe, or a woman that she used to work with. Her son got wrapped up in gangs out here in LA. He was in and out of prison. The last time he was out of prison, he was a mess. He was like, when I'm there, I know what I have to do. I know I'm going to get fed. I know where I'm going to sleep. I know who I'm going to have to deal with.
Right. So he's institutionalized. That's called institutionalization. Yep. And I would not call that a good thing, but it's something that people don't spring out of. They have to be, transitioned out of. And he did not get the transition. They just was released. Good luck. Have fun. It's not realistic. It's not how people work.
So I got to ask, because we got quite a few listeners from the UK, because I don't know if you know this, but that's where I'm from. I don't know if you noticed that. But so my dad, that was like part of his career. I talk about it a lot. And it's like a huge thing that inspired me within my life and my kind of, I guess, career then, I guess. He used to work with people like the most like high risk violent offenders who would get the care that they needed to transition out of prison and back into society in the UK.
What was his background?
So he was a sociologist. It's kind of a funny story. He's going to kill me for saying this. So I can't remember if the exact timeline was correct, but my parents had been married for about 10 years. Mm-hmm. And then my mom was like, God damn it, I'm having a baby. And my dad was like, no. And so then at that time he had to, like, I don't even think he graduated from high school, but had always worked. He was just like, it was back in the 70s. So, you could do that back then. Like, he was always a musician. Mm-hmm. And then so his training, he went to Swansea University, brilliant university. And I think he got a sociology degree. And then I can't remember what the exact training was, but I know he was working with the Swansea City, like, he was a social worker, probation officer.
Okay, that kind of thing. Okay,
so like that kind of thing. Yeah, okay, more. He was more like community based. He worked a lot with children.
The British do a lot of work with problematic offenders.
Oh,
they really do a lot of mental health work, and we do almost none. No. But go ahead.
This is what I was going to ask, because, like, I grew up with people who committed crimes and like it was just like a working class town. And then my dad would come home and tell me about all of these, like, you know, well, what he could tell me and what he was allowed to tell me and what he couldn't tell me, because it would scare me at that age. but it was nothing, not even close, compared to when I moved out here. I don't know if I've even told you this story. I got off the bus in like downtown LA, all my stuff on my backpack. The first time I came out here, got a cab from there to South Central to a soundstage, where I then spent the entire evening watching a performance by a group that was a majority reformed gang members from mostly Hispanic street gangs here in Los Angeles, and also some, like, from what I could tell, some like cartel stuff. And some of them had been to prison, and the only ones that have been to prison who you could tell were like probably not going to go back there were the ones who in that one context, who were very involved with like homeboy industries, who were very involved with church organizations, like big religious influence.
I do think we're going to have to lean on spiritual something.
Yeah. Whatever. Yeah, I think so.
Whatever is forgiven of it. They've got to find meaning outside of themselves.
That's the key. And that was something, you know, I come from like a very secular upbringing, and that was something that I kind of had to come to completely myself, was my own faith. And then also, you know, the science and this, or at least the social science kind of aligns that it seems to be, faith seems to be a really great little catalyst.
Well, yeah, especially when you're trying to change or overcome some bad stuff. Something meaning outside of you is critical.
But the difference being between the UK and the US, the people who I know who have been through prison out here in the US, they come out as just more constructed criminals traumatized human beings, like broken human beings.
They're oftentimes, yes.
Yeah.
I have some friends that turned it around in prison and took advantage of some of the stuff that goes on in there, but that's way exceptional.
Yeah. Huge exception. So what is it like? What is it like? I mean, have you worked with people directly as they're leaving prison with mental health issues? Like, have you worked with the kind of more criminally and things? My cousin, I think, actually applied to work at Broadmoor in the UK, which is our big scary facility where like the criminality.
There is a continuum from mental health issues into criminality, and they overlap a little bit, but there's a clearly criminality this thing that distinct from mental health, and it's terribly mysterious to me. It's when I encounter it, I know it, and it's essentially a abject lack of trust and an abject lack of willingness to change their way of thinking, and an unwillingness to even contemplate that somebody would be willing to help them.
So wait, let me get into this a little bit more, because there is a huge difference. And I think what most people could even make, like, probably take away from what Carol and I, and the way that we kind of present this information that I'm suddenly realizing, and this is something that I think that we're going to have to change or at least adapt to, is that we're not sitting here saying that like the people who roam the streets down in Venice or like across California, really, like these aren't all Richard Ramirez. These aren't people who like even know what they're doing half the time.
Right.
And in this kind of context, so that would be the kind of difference, right? There are the people who commit crimes because of their untreated mental illness.
Right.
And then there are people like the Richard Ramirez's of the world who commit crimes because they have there's just like a monster inside them that I guess could fall under a kind of, you could call it like a mental health issue, but I feel like that kind of doesn't really do justice to the scale of that issue.
Right.
Right.
I understand that the real criminals take advantage of the homeless. Those are the ones charging them rent for their place on the sidewalk and taking their disability checks and things, and trafficking the drugs and trafficking the women. And there is shit tons of that out there.
Oh my God. Like, do you hear about it up in Los Feliz, Nithya Raman's district? Like, ABC are reporting on it, I think, like every week now. There's a street gang out there. And like one of the like gang members actually had a conversation with the reporter.
Yeah.
Oh, no, like this is where we live now. This is just normal.
They're brazen. Yeah. I worry. I worry they have so much money that they're some of the stuff I see from the politicians is so mind-boggling. I keep thinking, are they under the influence of somebody? Or is that?
My money on Gascon being there's just even like the way his career progressed. Again, I don't even care if I'm going to get in trouble for saying this. I would put my nominal amount of money that I have on Gascon. There's no way you can make the kinds of decisions and the sweeping reforms that he's made without, it's like that show Mayans. It's like he's a local politician and they've just set him up to be in this position to get him to do everything they want. I apologize because I did not watch anything after season one of Mayans. Gonna be honest with you, I didn't like that they killed off Maurice Comte. I thought his character was brilliant. But like it's straight up like what we're seeing. It's the most ridiculous shit under the sun. And like when I first moved out here, I was like, oh, you know, I'd really like to study, you know, the cartels, and like I was working a lot with the gang members, and I was like, oh, this shit is way too fucking scary. Like, I'm gonna get myself killed. Like, no, don't want any part in this. And they are literally running the place now. I'm actually glad Carol's not on this episode because she'd like kill me for talking about it. But it also, is
speaking of running this place and not changing things. Did you see that they at Echo Park, they pulled out 35 tons of solid waste? That's why they had to clean the park up. Yeah.
My God. Yeah. And that's only the stuff that they're telling us about. Right. I just flew over Echo Park. I flew over on a helicopter ride, and it was with Group 3 Aviation. It was so much fun, but it was like they've done a great job on clearing it up. But like, I don't know that anyone's going to go back there still. And I wouldn't be surprised to see the tents back by the summer.
Well, I was going to say, how are they going to prevent that? But number two, why aren't they telling us what happened to the people who were moved to the room keys, the hotels, and got the treatment, and what's going on with them? How'd that turn out? Let's get some follow-up, everybody.
Oh, did they not? Because I thought I read somewhere. I feel like, or maybe it was a repost by Bill Malugin on Fox. He was talking about how I think about 180 of them got into Project Room Key, but maybe it was a repost. Because I said the other day, I think like, you know, those people have gotten into care. But yeah, no, that's all that I happened? Heard.
How are they doing? What's going on? Yeah, what do they feel about it now? Let's get some follow up so people can understand how this works.
Yeah, so we can actually go to other states. Because like you said something earlier, like, oh, we've got to find the stakeholders to, you know, do this research. Dude, that's us. Mm-hmm. Like at this point, let's be honest, like no one else is doing this. This is why like the guy, like we sat down with, like Carol and I sat down with people, you know, from DC last year. Like we've been working on this now, like it's been almost 2 years since we first started talking about it. Like no one else is really paying attention. The only other person that I've seen get up and say something is Caitlyn Jenner.
Interesting.
Yeah. And that's why, and the only people who are kind of like shitting on her at the moment seem to be the guys over at the Daily Wire, which I think is a shame, because I think they kind of miss that caveat with that, right? To be that kind of progressive Republican platform. Because Californians are welcoming her.
Yeah, I think it'll be very interesting. And if she comes up with some good policies, good. Fine.
Yeah.
So listen, while we're sitting here, I'm getting some desperate patient calls I've got to get to.
No,
so
yeah, you go. I've got to
wrap this up.
Yeah.
Sorry about that, but this is what happens to me once in a while. It's been a pleasure. Happy Friday. I think we brought up some really interesting stuff today, and people, I hope you'll think about it and apply it. And are you generating any kind of activism, any place people can go to be of help? Or
I mean, at this point, I think we're in a position where we're taking the show to a national platform, and all we ask of people is to just keep sharing it and keep getting informed, because as Carol says, it is not your federal government who are going to mess up your town. It is not your federal government who are going to let the homeless die on your streets. It's not the federal, it's all your local politicians. It's the kids who are running. It's, you know, your local librarians. Figure out who they are and speak with your vote. And that is the most important thing that we want people to do. And I think if we could generate any action from anything we're doing, it's that. Also, please send us money. No, but that's definitely in the pipeline. We're really trying to get people back into local politics and just keep sending a story. So thank you, Drew. Go save lives.
Okay.
You are a real doctor, which I think everyone needs to know about, and where you should probably be president, because this country needs one.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Do I need that though? Oh, Susan came in. What's that, Susan? Oh, she's listening to you talk. She says, no.
I didn't hear anything.
America needs a doctor president. So I'm going to vote for Drew. Anyway, have fun. Right. Have a fun weekend. And I'll speak to you soon. Bye.